From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Obamacare is having problems. In Maryland and across the country, health insurers are raising rates or pulling out of the state exchanges. Would a single-payer system work better? We ask health economist Bradley Herring of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School, what is a single-payer system?
If you look to other countries that have universal coverage, whether it's single-payer or a variant of the universal coverage, they all spend significantly less than we do here in the U.S.
We'll learn about what impact single-payer could have on health costs, as well as who would win and who would lose in a single-payer health plan. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Medicare for all, universal guaranteed health coverage, socialized medicine, all phrases you may have heard from political candidates this year. But do they all mean the same thing? What is a single-payer system anyway? Senator Bernie Sanders is a supporter, and Canada is probably the best-known practitioner. Today we'll get a lesson in single-payer 101. With healthcare costs in the U.S. rising, according to the Baltimore Business Journal, Maryland approved double-digit rate increases for all individual healthcare insurance plans for next year, including a 31% rate hike for CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield. And almost every week it seems there's news of an insurance company somewhere, like United Health Group, pulling out of one or more state exchanges. Could a single-payer system offer some solutions? With me to break this down is Dr. Bradley Herring. Bradley Herring is an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. His research focuses on economic and public policy issues related to health insurance coverage. Bradley Herring, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks.
In simplest terms, what is a single-payer system?
So I guess the simplest way to think about a single-payer system is one in which the government is the single payer for all healthcare services for all citizens. So Canada is probably the most obvious example of a single-payer system. People pay taxes to the Canadian government, and then the Canadian government in turn sends money to the provinces, and then those provinces pay hospitals and physicians, pay for pharmaceuticals. But essentially, the government is acting as the single insurer for everyone.
So some people heard government in your answer.
Yeah.
Big role for government, and they think socialized medicine.
So that raises an interesting issue. I mean, in some sense, I think a lot of times people use the term single payer to just think about universal coverage that all other OECD or all other high-income countries achieve. But there really is kind of a variation in terms of a country like Canada is a single payer in which the government acts as the insurer. A country like the UK actually collects taxes but then provides most of the health care.
So the government is actually the provider.
The provider, yeah, exactly. And then you can think of other countries like Germany, Switzerland, the Netherlands, in which the government takes a role in regulating private health insurance coverage. So people in those countries actually have private health insurance plans that pay private providers, but the government takes a much stronger role, like relative to here than the U.S., in terms of achieving that universal coverage.
So would you call the plan in Germany, for example, single payer?
So personally, I wouldn't, because I think I most often kind of equate single payer with a single health insurance plan. And in Germany and Switzerland and the Netherlands, people have choices among multiple different health insurance plans.
The phrase that Senator Bernie Sanders used in his quest for the Democratic nomination for president was Medicare for all. Is that the same?
I mean, that's probably not entirely accurate, because there would be some ways in which Medicare would probably differ from what the proposal Senator Sanders proposed. But big picture, yeah, like the Medicare program, which is a government program for the elderly and the disabled, we pay taxes into the system. That program pays private providers. That's kind of like the simplest way to really kind of wrap your head around the concept of a single payer.
So how would it work?
It's hard to know exactly how it worked, because you'd actually have to put details together and get everything kind of worked out. But I guess Most simply put, single payer would work in a way in which we would all pay taxes, right? Everybody who's working would pay taxes into a system, and that would in turn provide us with a government health insurance plan offered by the government. And that government plan would essentially pay hospitals and physicians prices that are essentially worked out between the government and those providers.
That's Bradley Herring, Associate Professor in Health Policy and Management at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, on the record here on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about health insurance, specifically, what is single payer? Would single payer save people, insured people, money?
I think for the most part, yes, it would. If you look to other countries that have universal coverage, whether it's single payer or a variant of universal coverage, they all spend significantly less than we do here in the U.S. And then even if you just look within the U.S. and kind of compare what spending is for public programs relative to private programs, private insurance, you'd certainly, I think, expect a Medicare for All program, a single payer program, to lower healthcare spending in the U.S.
Why would that be?
Three main reasons. One is that the government-run insurance plan would pay providers significantly less.
So providers would not make, doctors, hospitals, they would not make the same profits?
Yeah. So physicians' incomes would likely fall. Hospital profits would fall. And we can kind of look at that directly from just comparing what prices private health insurers pay providers versus what the Medicare and Medicaid programs pay providers. It's just significantly less for Medicare and Medicaid.
We hear from hospitals and other providers already that their profit margins aren't that high.
That's right. A lot of hospitals argue, and I think this is supported, that they essentially kind of cross-subsidize the money they lose on seeing Medicare and Medicaid patients by charging private health-insured patients more. That actually doesn't really work here in Maryland because Maryland has a hospital rate setting system, but all other states in the country like have this variation in terms of private prices being higher than public prices.
So you were walking me through where savings might come from. You said just lower reimbursements or lower payments to providers. Also, I assume some administrative savings.
That's right. Yeah, so that's the second big one. So administrative costs would fall because private health insurers have higher administrative overhead than the Medicare program has. And so you kind of think about that in two main dimensions. One is just the profits that private health insurance companies earn. That's a component of their administrative overhead. But another aspect of the higher administrative costs for private health insurance are the additional administrative costs of marketing, administering claims, doing medical underwriting, a whole host of activities that private health insurers have to undertake to make a profit.
How big a portion of what insurers spend?
Yeah, so
goes
it's a relatively big portion. It's for private health insurance plans. I think the data indicates that maybe about 12% of the premium we pay is administrative overhead that the insurance companies keep, with the remaining 88% going out the door to pay for hospitals, physicians, pharmaceuticals. For the Medicare program, the estimates of administrative costs are more along the lines of like 2-3% as a fraction of total healthcare spending.
So smaller payments to providers like hospitals and doctors, less spent on administrative costs. Other savings?
I think those are really the big two.
On the other hand, if there's a single payer system and I've sort of prepaid through my taxes, so I'm not paying premiums.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just going to use every bit of medical attention I can get, right? I'm going to go for every test that makes sense to me as a consumer of
healthcare. Yeah.
So that's exactly right. So that's kind of like the third main piece that kind of offsets those two savings, right? So if the savings are the lower provider prices and the reduction in administrative costs for private insurance relative to public insurance, those savings get offset a little bit by the increased utilization of mainly formerly uninsured people who will start to consume more healthcare. I mean, kind of think about that as a good thing. But your question is kind of getting at another aspect, which is people who have health insurance coverage now might utilize more healthcare services if their health insurance coverage becomes more generous. And along this notion of more generous, the single payer advocates have talked about having health insurance coverage, you know, have minimal or perhaps no co-payments, deductibles, co-insurance. And so you're right. When that happens, right, people kind of respond to that by being more likely to go to the doctor, getting more expensive treatments, more expensive pharmaceuticals. Much of the time, that's a good thing, right? We want people to have improved access. But on the other hand, there's many instances where that increased utilization isn't necessarily high-value care.
And what do the experts think about whether the increased use of healthcare would produce such a much better health status that within a few years, people would be healthier and would need less health care? Would you end up with savings, or do experts think no?
The main conclusion that on that one is the experts probably say no, that generally won't happen. And to take a bigger step back, I mean, the overall savings of administrative costs, lower provider prices, those will probably be larger than the offsetting increased costs of utilization. So on net, single payer would save money. But then, yeah, focusing on this issue of, well, if people are spending more money and consuming more healthcare, does it make them healthier? And does it in turn reduce future healthcare spending? The data and the evidence don't really support that strongly in terms of big improvements in health or large reductions in future savings.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, here with Bradley Herring, Associate Professor in Health Policy and Management at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're talking about health insurance, specifically what a single-payer system is and how it might work. We talked about people using a lot of health care and what that might do to costs. Could the health care system cope with this extra use? Would there just be like long wait times?
So I think that's the big unanswered question. And in some sense, like if you look to other countries, there's certainly anecdotal evidence and maybe even some systematic evidence of those countries coping with the pressure by having queues, you know, waiting to get access to treatment, perhaps as the UK has done through its National Health Service, maybe not covering certain treatments that a government agency views as not having high value.
Are we talking about rationing?
Yes, it's indeed rationing.
In the vice presidential debate, the Republican vice presidential candidate Mike Pence asserted that Hillary Clinton intends to replace Obamacare with a single-payer system, which she has not said. She has talked about public option. What does public option have to do with single-payer, or does it?
So if you go back, if you rewind and recall the debates between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, single-payer was actually a big thing that they kind of argued about, where Bernie Sanders said he's, you know, definitely in favor of the Affordable Care Act, but would much prefer a single payer system. Whereas Hillary Clinton kind of countered with emphasizing a lot of the negative aspects of a single payer system because she wanted to, you know, be supportive of the Affordable Care Act and President Obama. One of the things that was a big points of controversy when passing the Affordable Care Act back in 2009 up to 2010, when it actually passed, was the so-called public option. So right now, many people are getting private health insurance plans through these new marketplaces or exchanges, right? So government insurance, Medicare and Medicaid programs, cover those populations. But for everybody else, it's basically an option of which private health insurance plan do you choose among? So many advocates of a more government-oriented system have advocated for the so-called public option, which would essentially be having a government-run plan competing alongside the private health insurance plans in these marketplaces for health insurance coverage. So individuals might have the option of choosing a public plan as opposed to, say, Evergreen, Kaiser Permanente, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, CareFirst. And so that, in turn, is one of the big policy proposals that Hillary Clinton is pushing forward on now.
I realize you're an economist, not a political analyst, but do you have the sense now that Bernie Sanders is not a candidate for president that there is a great momentum to changing something? I mean, Hillary Clinton seems to have said repeatedly that she'd like to avoid another big fight over health care.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me what Donald Trump says.
Yeah, Donald Trump's healthcare proposals are hard to follow. I'll say that for sure. But I mean, as far as Hillary Clinton goes, she, I guess, along with many Democrats, have had kind of a somewhat difficult line to walk, which is on one hand, trying to be very supportive of the Affordable Care Act and trumpet all of its achievements. But then on the other hand, you know, think about improvements or fixes that could be done to make the Affordable Care Act work better. And so I think so far, Hillary Clinton and other Democrats have been a little wary of talking too loudly about any problems with the Affordable Care Act that need fixing, because I think they're wary of admitting that the Affordable Care Act isn't perfect. And so one of the things Hillary's been talking about is this notion of the public option. Another one is trying to emphasize the rising cost of pharmaceutical drugs. We'll see what happens in terms of new initiatives to expand on the Affordable Care Act.
So we'll have more conversations probably after the election. Thank you very much for this conversation.
You're welcome. Yeah, happy to be here.
Bradley Herring is an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. His field of research is economic and public policy issues related to health insurance coverage. A quick break now, and then a very different approach to discussing health. I'm Sheila Cast, On the Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm producer Maureen Harvey. Mental illness and comedy may seem like an unlikely combination, but a group of local improv performers has taken on the challenge. The Best Medicine Show, coming this weekend to Baltimore's Single Carrot Theater, pairs improvisers with true stories solicited from the community. All the stories have something to do with mental illness. Matthew Manning is a writer, actor, psychiatric nurse, and the founder of The Best Medicine. So, Matt, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me, Maureen.
How does this work? You have stories that people share and then improv?
The first thing about how it works is it seems like it shouldn't work. The setup is that we have guests from the community come and read true stories of how mental illness affects their life. And these stories are sometimes really sad. Sometimes they can be funny. A lot of times they're a combination of both, but almost all the time they're very powerful stories. And while they're doing that, we have a team of improvisers waiting in the wings, kind of listening very closely to what they're saying. And then when they're done, they go up on stage and using ideas that they've generated from the stories, they create comedic scenes.
I also want to introduce Michael Johnson. Michael Johnson is an actor and mental health professional. He's performed at previous Best Medicine shows. Michael, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us what your story was about?
When Matt had asked me to do this show, I was going through, I'll try to keep this clean. I was going through the stuff at the moment. And I tried to talk about what was going on with me right there at that present time in my life. And it was about me breaking down at lunch at a Chipotle, sobbing into my burrito at like midday. And I'm very forthright. I try to be, because I feel like holding things in has never worked for me in the past. But I've also learned that the audience needs permission. And I do remember like getting into the story and having to ad lib like right at the beginning, telling them like, you know, you're allowed to laugh. This is funny to me, and it's still funny even though this happened like 10 days ago.
The idea of having to give the audience permission to laugh. As a performer, how are you sensing that, and what are you doing?
I feel it. You know, and I've performed long enough, and it's not to sound arrogant, but, you know, when you're writing something, you're like, okay, this will get a laugh, or, you know, this will be a laugh. And when those pieces early on, you know, just not hitting, and you can tell, you can feel when the audience is pulling back. Luckily, I'm experienced enough to know that, okay, I can step out of the script here and ad lib a little bit, because I want them to not feel like they're laughing at me. You know, I feel like so much of this is so difficult that to laugh with me is the most therapeutic thing for me.
Matt Manning, can you tell me what is your goal with this show? What do you want to accomplish for both the performers and the audience?
I think if we take a look at what Michael just said, him and I are both mental health care professionals, and we are supposed to deliver care, whether that's counselors or therapists, psychiatric nurses, psychiatrists. We are supposed to deliver care in this vacuum, from a place of tabula rasa, that we are just these blank slates by which we reflect off the patients. But of course, that isn't true. The reality is that we have universes of feeling inside of us. We have loss, we have grief, we have anticipation, we have hope, and we are bringing those things to work every day. And that's why stories like Michael's are so important to tell, because of the way they show, in which, you know, this is something that touches everyone, even the ones that work with those that deal with this. And then also it expands the scope to say that, you know, not only is it the person going through it themselves, but also their family. It is that reflex that we are trying to play with a little bit, which is that when you tell these very serious stories, there's a lot of pent-up tension. But in real life, there is not just tension, there is also release. And so when we pair these stories with the breaks with the comedic improvisation, it allows for that release of tension, which leads to not only a very satisfying entertainment experience, but also overall it loosens up the tightness or the tension around the conversation about mental illness, and it makes it okay to talk about it and not always in such a dire way.
Michael Johnson, you've also performed doing the improv after somebody has shared their stories. That seems really risky. How do you find the right balance and pick up on what moments you can play with?
Sometimes something will happen during a story that as the storyteller, you may not hear or even realize. And sometimes you can play with that. The only thing that you don't want to play with is, for example, someone that's bipolar and is experiencing extreme mood swings or mania, playing the a caricature of someone with bipolar, that's the kind of stuff that's just not going to resonate with the audience. It's not going to resonate on stage. It's just, you know, it's the lowest common denominator. What you're looking for are moments of truth that you can play with the mantra, you know, if this is true, what else must be true?
Matt, can you tell me afterward, what do you hear from the people who have shared their stories and the people who, the improvisers who've performed?
From the people that share their stories, I hear a lot of gratitude, which makes me feel really good, because a lot of times the symptoms of mental illness makes it very hard, believe it or not, to step up on a stage and share these things. So for me as the producer of the show, not only is it kind of making sure the performers show up on time and hit the right marks like it would be in a normal show, but along the way there's a lot of coaching in terms of writing their stories as well as building themselves up to tell the story. And so when that's over, I do hear a lot of gratitude, or sometimes I will hear people saying, "That was amazing. Don't ever make me do that again." from the improvisers, I just have repeat customers, people that were nervous about doing the show at first, and then after they do it, they're like, "That was amazing. I want to do it again," because you do really feel like you created something incredible.
Matthew Manning is a writer, actor, psychiatric nurse, and the creator of the storytelling and improv event, The Best Medicine. And Michael Johnson is an actor and healthcare worker who's performed at previous shows. Thank you both for talking to me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maureen.
The Best Medicine will be staging two shows at 3 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. on Sunday, October 16th at Single Carrot Theater on North Howard Street. Ticket information is available at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm producer Maureen Harvey. Thanks for listening and tune in tomorrow.